And we thank you for listening to the Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network. In the next hour, we're going to have a special guest, Simon Roche from South Africa, joining me and my co-host Wills. Stay tuned. We'll be right back right after this song.
I had this crazy dream about some folks who love this country, who all began to dream the same dream. And when the morning came, there arose across this nation people thinking one and the same. And they awoke to find their freedoms and all their liberties had gradually been taken away. And when they realized the danger to their posterity, I heard those patriotic people say, we want this country back. We ain't just joking, Jack. We want our liberty and our dignity and our freedoms and our rights restored. We want this country back. She's been way off track. We're wide awake and we're madder than hell now, and we ain't gonna take it anymore. No, we're not gonna take it anymore. Remember golden days when the stars and stripes forever symbolized her glorious name, America. Now it's all been changed, and when we gaze upon old glory, it's hard to fight back feelings of shame. We're fed up with lying politicians and greedy corporations who have sold us out time and again. And we're sick and tired of sending our soldiers off to wars that we were never meant to win. We want this country back. We ain't just joking, Jack. We want our liberty and our dignity and our freedoms and our rights restored. We want this country back. She's been driven way off track. We're wide awake and we're madder than hell now, and we ain't gonna take it anymore. Cause it's right, and our victory's on the way, and we won't give up the fight till we hear 200 million say, we want this country back. We ain't just joking, Jack. We want our liberty and our dignity and our freedoms and our rights restored. We want this country back, and we ain't taking any more flack. We're wide awake and we're madder than hell now, and we ain't gonna take it anymore. No, we're not gonna take it anymore. That's right, we're not gonna take it anymore. We said we're not gonna take it anymore. That's right, we're not gonna take it anymore.
Well, folks, I want to thank you for listening to the Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network. We have a special program for you today. And with me this morning, I've got Will on the line. Good morning, Will.
Good morning.
And we've got a special guest coming to us from a long ways away. We've got Simon Roche. Simon, thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you very much for having Saitlanders on your show. We appreciate it, the opportunity.
Well, we're glad that we could make this happen. And I know that you're coming from so right now you're currently in Moscow, from what I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I've just come from not inside the Kremlin. I wasn't having tea with Putin, but right next to the Kremlin. Just come from a meeting with some very prestigious person. And I'm back at my little hotel room.
Okay, well, fantastic. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to be here this morning. So there's a lot of stuff going on. South Africa has been in the news quite a bit as of late. And, you know, we know that, you know, me and Will have been talking about it on the radio and talking about just some of the genocides and stuff that's taken place over there. But why don't you just start off by giving us a little bit of a background on yourself and the Sidelanders? And let's just start off there, if you don't mind.
Yeah, certainly. I'm a guy in his 50s. I have a few sons. I work for Saitlanders, which is an organization devoted to executing or implementing a national emergency plan for our people, our folk, in the event of a catastrophe in South Africa. It's very simple. It's not nearly as spicy and racist and alarming as people make it out to be. The Geneva Conventions make provision for identifiable ethnic groups like the Bosniaks and the Croats and the Slovenes and the Serbs and so on in the breakup of Yugoslavia for identifiable ethnic groups to plan in the event that they anticipate fractiousness in their society. And so we're devoted to the Afrikaner and white peoples of South Africa. We're totally a civil defense organization. It's not about bombs and nuclear missile carriers. It's about, if there's a breakdown in our society, how do we remove ourselves from a conflict? How do we go to a safer place and safeguard the welfare of our civilian? It's really not very much more interesting than that, although people make it out to be some kind of, you know, crazy thing.
We understand that quite well.
Yeah.
How long have you been involved with the Sidelanders?
I got involved. Gee, that's a blooming good question. I got involved almost precisely 10 years ago. It would have been coming towards the end of May 2015. Yeah. Initially, I was, you know, I did a lot of work for our government and for the ruling political party, the African National Congress, because I was quite senior in my profession, which is project management of what's known as special projects. It's basically live events, but not birthday parties and bar mitzvahs, opening ceremonies of World Cups, inaugurations of presidents, global broadcast, that sort of thing. So, you know, if you do that well, it's a bit like road building anywhere in the world. You could be a good road builder and your government could be the worst government in the world. Muammar Gaddafi, or take your favorite object of hate. If you're a good road builder, you're going to be building roads for Muammar Gaddafi no matter what your sympathies are or your political orientation. So I was in that environment where, at the top of that profession, I was inevitably going to do a lot of work for and with the government, and it wore on my conscience very heavily, and I prayed about it for about 10 years, almost exactly 10 years to get out of it. And I was still in it when I finally decided I'm going to, you know, start working more according to my conscience, and I started doing a little bit of work for Saitlanders, but very much, you know, clandestinely. Because I would have gotten into a lot of trouble. There's this false perception, you know, about Saitlanders. And then eventually I kind of left that entire world behind me. And in 2017, out of the blue, you know, people perceive me as this kind of tame white boy who towed the quasi-communist or socialist line of the new South Africa Rainbow Nation. I went from being viewed as that, helping people to steal, you know, money and all sorts of things as happened in that environment. It's just the way it works. To suddenly being touring the USA out of the blue over the span of about 4 days, I left that environment and began a tour of the USA to raise awareness of Saitlanders, and we were there for 6 months in 2017, a bunch more times in 2018, and then 2019 before the lockdowns in 2020, and then again in 2023. So I've spent over the past 7 or 8 years, about a year in total in the USA, and then, of course, we've been to the European Parliament and the Bundestag and other places, and I'm in Russia now at the invitation of the Russian government, of certain members of the government, and also organs of state that have mandates to, you know, show the best side of Russia. The same people who invited Judge Andrew Napolitano and Tucker Carlson and so on, these big names that have conducted huge interviews in Moscow in recent months. I think that's the rundown.
Well, fantastic. We'll appreciate that.
Simon, kind of for the edification of our listening audience, can you talk about the history of the Saitlanders as far as how they came to be? Maybe some of the prophecies that that were foretold that I don't know. I don't want to say that the Saitlanders is based on, but associated with at least.
Yeah, our leader and founder, Mr. Gustav Müller, was driving in his motor car one day, just at the time of the first multiracial elections in South Africa on the 27th of April, 1994. And the way he says it very modestly when he tells the story, he just had some kind of a, this is my word now, he's more modest, some kind of an epiphany, a realization that what was being stitched together was tenuous, and it was based largely on goodwill and people saying this is going to work and it's going to be great and it's fantastic. And he just had this kind of impression that, no, it's not as simple as that. And over time, his convictions developed until eventually he founded the organization based on two things. Number one, let's say three things. Number one, that premonition, for want of a better word. Number two, the clearly visible evidence that the African National Congress and the New South Africa Rainbow Nation were nothing like what they were cracked up to be. And number three, the prophecies of a guy called Nicolaas, the Dutch spelling and pronunciation of the word, the name Nicholas, Nicolaas van Rensburg, van being with a Germanic V, so a soft V, van Rensburg. this man, he went gray very in his late teens. He was a sort of a strange character who was very pious, and he was in the Dutch Reformed tradition. It's impossible for this to happen. Certainly in those days it was impossible, but he was made an elder of the church in his early 20s at the age of 21 or 22 because he was just regarded as the super pious chap. And then he began to have a series of 740 or so visions from his 20s up till the time that he passed away in 1926 at the age of 64. So the visions pertained mostly to the Boer folk, but also to the rest of the world. To give you one classic vision, so the visions fall into roughly three categories: those that are self-evident, those that are open to some analysis. They have to be worked out well. You have to have a good idea of the imagery. You have to have a good idea of the leitmotifs in his visions. In other words, what a red candelabra cactus means over the span of 40 years in his visions. And then you have that category, which is not inscrutable, but has possibly not been resolved to this day, where some people who've adopted a scholarly approach still don't know what they mean. So the easy ones are ones like this. He says there will be a black president of the United States of America. He will be like the rope leader of a team of oxen towing a wagon. In Dutch, because what he was speaking at the time was prior to the formalization of Afrikaans, which is the language of the Boers today, a toeleierkie, that this little, as he describes him, this little black boy will pivot the United States of America away from its traditional orientation. And then along comes a very bright, intelligent white guy, and he takes over the rope, the reins, if you like. But if you imagine the rope at the head of a team of oxen, pulling in the nose of the senior of the two lead oxen to steer an ox wagon on a route, that this guy comes along, and he's a very intelligent guy. He has hair like a wig. This is what I've just said to you is a highly controversial thing, and I don't want to tell lies, but it has generally been understood that the meaning of the word, of the phrase, or the phrase is, "Die man het 'n pluisskuil kuif." The man has a head of hair resembling a, oh, this is impossible, resembling plumage.
Okay.
Okay.
And he is a very strong man. He pivots the United States back toward its traditional orientation. And then he is trampled on by this is rough. It's not controversial, but it's an approximation. He's trampled on by the white oxen. The white oxen in Sina von Rensburg. Sina means seer. So I introduced him to you as Nikolaus von Rensburg, but he goes by the title either uncle. In our society, anybody that's 10 years older than you is an uncle. If you don't use uncle, the word uncle, yeah, it's regarded as it's unforgivably bad manners. So he goes by the title of Oom Sina von Rensburg, so Uncle Sia von Rensburg, something like that. So he said that this guy is trampled on by the white oxen, and the white oxen in all of his visions represent the spine, the strength, maybe the governance, maybe the military of the USA. So he is betrayed by the powers that be of the USA. You can impute the words deep state, if you like, or powers
that be. Deep state, yeah, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
So they betray him, they trample him underfoot. And then it kind of ends there. There's no like second installment. You know, he bounces back for a second term, or there's nothing like that. But that's from day
and
one.
Simon, yeah. This would have been the 19th century, the 1800s.
He was born in 1862 and died in 1926. That particular vision comes from the late teens or the early 20s of the last century. So roughly 115 years ago, I forget the date of, I've interwoven three prophecies into one for your benefit. I forget the dates of those three prophecies that have always been understood to pertain to one another, but they were not given on the same day.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so that's the inspiration for Saitlanders. Our leader said, let's do it. Let's make preparations. And if nothing ever goes wrong in our society, we haven't lost much, but now he's looking like, not to be sort of heretical, but the Sikhs believe in five gurus, and he's looking like guru number six, nobody had the prescience and foresight of our leader 25 or 30 years ago. Right at the moment, our society is so fractious that even hardcore liberals are talking in terms of catastrophe and calamity,
Simon, just for the benefit of our audience and having you here, like Jason said, we've regularly on Saturdays, we talk about South Africa, But, you know, we're two guys that are Americans talking about South Africa. So while you're here with us, could you just give us a brief thumbnail of kind of the settlement of South Africa? Because I think there's a lot of misconceptions of the founding of South Africa, an indigenous population that may not have really been there. You know, what was there when the Dutch went there? Simon, can you tell us about that for just a minute?
Yeah, in my opinion, if anybody wants to corroborate what I'm saying or do independent research, the best book on this subject is by an American whose name escapes me now, but the title of the book is, if I remember it correctly, The Vow. It's a guy who wrote, I think he wrote A History of Hawaii. He was into writing like multi-hundred-year sagas, American author. Very, very, you know, one of the great authors of the 20th century. And so what I'm going to say is in academic circles is not controversial at all. There's absolute consensus on this. In South Africa, it's roughly speaking a circle. It's not circular in shape, but just to keep things simple, if you drew a line from northwest to southeast, or from on a clock face from 10 o'clock down to 4 o'clock, the bottom left hand, or the southwest, if you like, portion of South Africa was populated by very, very small populations of proto-Aboriginal people. That is to say, Bushmen, Hottentots, Topnar, Griqua, small little people who had largely come out of the other portion of South Africa where they'd lived for however many thousand years. When the Zulu people and the Xhosa people came down from East Africa in the 1500s, they came across these tiny little delicate folk, and they killed almost all of them. I come from the province where they originated, and I lived there for the first 27 years of my life, and I never met one Bushman. They were all wiped out, killed by the Zulus. And the remnants of them fled into the southwest portion, the southwest half of South Africa, which is largely semi-desert. And we know that that's a fact because all, approaching 100% of their famous rock art, is in that province that I come from, where they are not to be found at all. So that was where they had lived for millennia, and then in a short span of time, they were chased out and they had to run away. And just a tiny handful of them remained over. And as luck would have it, the Dutch arrived in 1652 to set up a way station because of scurvy, people not getting enough adequate vitamin C on long sea journeys from Holland to the East Indies to trade spices. The journeys were too long. The sailors would get scurvy. They would die. Their joints would swell up. They wouldn't be able to work. And it was somebody worked out that it was to do with fresh food. And so they set up a halfway house at the Cape of Storms, now called the Cape of Good Hope, but originally called the Cape of Storms. And they put a few dozen Hollanders there to grow crops so that the Dutch trading ships could, you know, pull in for a pit stop, get fresh greenery, and then carry on the journey to prevent the sailors getting scurvy. Those peoples became what's known as the Trekboeren. Trekboeren, like Star Trek, that comes from South African, from Afrikaans, the word trek means to pull. So they were the pull Boers or the itinerant Boers. So a portion of those people from 1652, I should mention, was joined by the Huguenots of France in 1688. And then in the 1690s, a whole lot of German orphans, girls, female orphans, were brought from Germany. So the Afrikaner Boer folk of today is made up of Dutch, Huguenot, French, and German, roughly equally. It might be 50, 30, 20, or 40, 40, 20, but it's not 95 and 5%.
Right.
they amalgamated, and then some of them started to leave for various references, and they became known as the itinerant farmers, the Trekboeren. In all of that bottom left-hand corner of South Africa, there was no contact with black people, because there were no black people, as you know black people. I'm not talking about the little teeny tiny little Aboriginal people, mere handfuls of them, those that had survived the genocide of the Zulus and the Xhosas. Very, very, very few of them. I don't remember the figures out of my head, but they run to thousands, perhaps 10,000. They had been so severely wiped out by the Zulus and the Xhosa people. In my province of KwaZulu-Natal, as it's known now, Natal, when I was a child. So there was no contact until, dear me, about 1778, I believe, a commander of the garrison at the fort of Cape Town set out to look for slaves because he knew that there was slavery. The Arabs were, as you may or may not know, there's this sort of paroxysm of self, guilt in the USA over slavery. But anybody who knows a very little bit about the subject knows that by far the majority of slavery during the times of slavery was conducted between the east coast of Africa and Arabia. The reason that there are no remnants of the slaves in Arabia to this day is because they were all neutered upon arrival so that they wouldn't procreate. Whereas, and then of the balance of the slave trade, that tiny portion that was conducted over the Atlantic Ocean between the west coast of Africa and the Americas, the overwhelming majority, I used to know the figures out of my head, was conducted between the Brazilian and French settlements in, obviously, or the Portuguese and French settlements in Brazil and the Caribbean, and a small handful was conducted with the south of the United States. So this guy knew that on the east coast of Africa was the global slave trade being taken to the Arab lands. And he thought, well, if I march up the east coast of Africa, before I get to the great slave ports in northern Mozambique and Tanzania and Kenya, I'm going to maybe find some more black people. We don't have any here. We've only got these tiny little dwarf people, and there are only, you know, half a dozen of them in the entire place. So that's no good to us. I'm going to go in search. And it took him 2 years on horseback to find the first black people in South Africa. So that is my long-winded way of explaining to you that this myth, this fiction, this figment of people's imaginations about the settlement of South Africa and how it worked and who was where is absolute rubbish. It's absolute poppycock. It's like land ownership in South Africa. To give you an idea, and I won't make this sermon too much longer, the province that I come from, the province which is the traditional home of the Zulu people, has since forever, during apartheid, during the worst of the evils of the terrible white supremacists of South Africa, 32% of it has belonged to the Zulu king and his people. There was never a time that whites took over the whole of South Africa, took the best for themselves, and made the blacks live on 3% of the land, or 7%, whatever the daft number that keeps doing the round. There was never a time that the white conquerors or whatever did not give 32% of that province, that's just one province, the same with the others, to the Zulu king. Now that excludes, let's say the Zulu people, that excludes all black suburban land. And anybody who's visited South Africa knows that the black, what are known as townships around, we're talking about my province, around Durban, run to tens of millions of people. So it's probably safe to say that something like 40% of the rural land of that province is owned by blacks, and of the urban land, probably 60%. I'm kind of guessing. And then the state owns a whole lot of land as well. So that's just to give a sense of perspective. It's a bit like going to court and your wife says to the judge, gee, hit me 10 times and whatever, I want a very favorable divorce settlement. And you say to the court, I did punch her. It's the greatest shame of my life. I invite you, Your Honor, to punish me fully. But please don't punish me for punching her 10 times. Here is CCTV evidence of the fact that, in fact, it was only one. Punish me fully, but don't punish me for things I didn't do. So that gives a sense of perspective on those poppycock numbers that these people keep on regurgitating. How they get away with it, I don't know. But that's the rough idea of the settlement patterns of South Africa.
Along the lines of revisionist history, Simon, and I appreciate the education. It's great having, in my opinion, a direct line source of information. You mentioned just a few moments ago apartheid, and you know, I grew up. I was a teenager in the 90s, and I remember, you know, obviously it being international news as far as the end of apartheid and the rise of Nelson Mandela, and you know what was shoved down our throats here in the United States as far as truth through the media. And obviously I've spent some time in my adulthood learning more about apartheid and more about the ANC and Nelson Mandela and that sort of stuff. I would like to hear in your voice, in your words, a definition of apartheid, what that really was, why that was set up. I believe it was in 1948. And maybe what led to its end in 94, if you don't mind.
Okay, there were four. I beg your pardon.
No, I was just going to ask you, in addition to that, and I'm sorry, it's a big ask from you, but really I'm looking for an education for not only myself, but for our audience too. South Africa is all the rage in the news right now. Maybe in the telling of what apartheid was, why it came about, can you also describe maybe the normal life for a white South African citizen, a black South African citizen, of what it was really like, because that was, you were there, you grew up in it.
Yeah, well, in 1807, Britain banned the slave trade throughout the empire. In 1834, they banned the ownership of slaves. And by that time, Britain had conquered the Western Cape of South Africa, so the far southwestern portion of South Africa. And the Trekboeren ran away. They said, we don't want to live under Britain taking our slaves away from us. And they went into the interior and they established three republics. I'm going to tell this in the simplest possible way. So South Africans, please don't pick bones with me over the simplicity. We don't have all day and all night to talk about this. So there was a British kind of a province, and then there were these three Trekboeren provinces. The one was later stolen. To cut a long story short, diamonds were discovered in these provinces, and then gold. And Britain invaded. And Britain was thrashed and ran away with its tail between its legs and came back just short of 30 years later with a force roughly 20 times larger than the populations of these Boer republics, and beat them in that second war, which ended in 1902. And in 1910, Britain founded the Union of South Africa. In so doing, the British established a system of laws to divide the peoples. Previously, there had not been. So the Afrikaners, the Boers, didn't approach it that way. Their approach was, we'll find a modus vivendi with the blacks. They can have their place where we won't conquer them, and hopefully they won't conquer us. Now, a vital thing to understand is at that time, the population, the black population of South Africa, had just been through an internecine squabble called the Mfikane, which means the Great Crushing, and this is well recorded by liberals, missionaries, over and over and over again, it's the missionaries, British missionaries who record this, about two-thirds of the black population was killed. They killed one another, leaving something like 1 million people on this large piece of land, which is about double the size of Texas. Almost exactly double the size of Texas. So it was very empty land. And the missionaries recorded over and over and over again how they would travel for days and days and days and not see sign of human life, only bones and burned out kraals. It was a very vicious event, the Umfitane. So there was space for people to live. So the Boers' attitude was, look, we're going to establish republics here. We see you've got your little kingdom over there. Who cares? Get on, mind your own business, and we'll mind our own business. And they were doer Protestants. They were the most doer Protestants of all Protestants, deeply religious people. For them, they just wanted to mind their own business. There were clashes, but there weren't serious wars like in some other places in the world. Along come the British. They want the gold and the diamonds, not for the British, but for other ethnic groups that, you know, none of those mines went to ethnic British citizens. But they fought on behalf of other peoples. And so they stole the gold and the diamond mines from the Boers. And then they said, we need a system. And they came up with the apartheid laws, but not the word apartheid. This is in roughly from 1902 to 1910, 11, 12. 50 years down the line, in 1961, South Africa gained independence from Britain. Along come the Boers. They now win parliamentary elections, and we've got our first fully independent, state. And one of the architects of that new Afrikaner, young South Africa energy came up with nomenclature. He was a scholarly man. He had all sorts of PhDs and other degrees. And he said, we'll formalize it. We'll call it apartheid, apartness. We will keep apart from one another. But the laws that it was too late to bring in any law. Laws have been brought in by the British, the separate development, the separate living areas, the separate everything, which is not to say that the government, the white government of South Africa, never did anything apartheid-like. But the suggestion that they came up with it is just false. It's only ignorant people say that, because it's well understood by anybody, who knows anything about this subject, that all of apartheid, from the Alpha to the Omega, was brought in by the British. They believed that this modus vivendi, where the Boers and the kings had a kind of a handshake deal, you over there, me over here, all right, you get on with your thing, I do my thing, it wasn't good enough for the British. So that's the story. Now, to move on to the, is that good enough, or do you want me to say anything?
Oh, no, that's, Jason, did you have anything on that?
No, I don't think so. That gives me a lot better education than what I ever knew about. So I think that was good.
I guess to summarize in my simple mind, Simon, you're saying that the laws that came to be known as apartheid were put in place by the British, and it was a British construct that was just renamed later by the Afrikaans people.
Yeah, later on comes this Dr. H.F. Verwoerd. Was his name, mm-hmm. And he says, well, maybe we should tweak it here, maybe we should tweak it there, maybe we should make the black areas a little bit more structured, let's give them some extra land. He gave the blacks a whole lot of extra land that kind of alienated him from his voting base. They hated him for doing that. But his reasoning was that the black population is absolutely exploding. Let's placate them by giving them some state land, and, it'll make the whole arrangement feasible for a little while longer. But that was from 1961. In 1948, a conservative government came in, but it was under, we were part of the British Empire.
Still part of Britain.
Yeah. Apartheid only lasted from 1961 until 1994, 33 years, boom, clock. Almost 33 years to the day, just a few days apart from 33 years.
Well, so, here in America, you know, I think we are to believe that that 33-year period was maybe the most racist time frame in the history of man, is how it's portrayed a lot as far as the South African government toward the blacks during apartheid. And that kind of goes to my question of what was life really like in that 33-year period as far as South Africa and the functioning of the government, and more importantly, the relationships of all the ethnic people together.
Well, the relationships were not bad. I don't recall. I mean, we had people working in our house, and my mother never shouted at them or anything like that. People working in the garden, as one had. My dad was the factory manager of one of the largest match factories in the world. And the day that he took early retirement, all the black workers lined up an honor guard as he walked out. And, I wasn't there to see it, but apparently to a man, they wept. But my parents were conservative. They weren't beloved for being liberal. They were just people who treated other people in a certain way. And I suppose it's not nice to be a second-class citizen. I'm not wishing apartheid on anybody. All I'm saying is that, to give you some examples, first heart transplant in the world took place in South Africa. And there are many other things that we did before anybody else. You know, we were at one time the world leaders in drone technology. And then, you know, everything's kind of collapsed in the past 35 years. But there was nobody more advanced than we were in drone technology. And we had nuclear bombs and what have you. You know, it was easy enough to do for us. The interpersonal relations, you know, when I was in my teens, I was part of a number of, like, exercises where a black school, a white school, and an Indian school. Where I grew up is, it may not be the case anymore today. I've recently been in the USA. I'm sure that you've overtaken us in terms of the largest population of Indians outside of India. But that was, we were always renowned for having the largest population of Indians outside of India. And so those, you know, it's like six schools, two representing each race, because we didn't have the traditional fourth race of South Africa, the colored, the mixed race people who insist upon being called colored. I don't know. I don't remember antipathy or fractiousness. But then again, I'm not black, so I'm not really entitled to have an opinion. But, but by and large, it was okay. You know, my dad got on well with his 5,000 factory workers. Even my mom got on well with all the people in the house. I cannot remember her ever having strong words with a single person. I don't know. Make of it what you will, really.
Let me ask this, and I would appreciate correction if I'm wrong, because a lot of this is just, you know, looking at news coverage and that sort of. It appears now that the current state of South Africa, there is a very high level of violence. And I know the homicide rate there, if it's not number one in the world, it has to be close. Was there anything like that during that time frame? Or is this a relatively new phenomenon in South Africa?
There was nothing like that. I'm sorry to. It's just the way you put the question was so, like, it kind of invited. No, I don't mean to be, but no, heavens above, no, dear me, no. I'm in Russia at the moment.
Yes.
When I got here, I rang one of my sons, and I said to him, the biggest lie ever told in the world was clearly COVID. The second biggest lie ever told in the world was clearly the clot shot. The third biggest lie ever told in the world was Russia, and the fourth biggest, South Africa. If you go on YouTube to do research, you can find, I'm sure, 5,000 videos on popping pimples. 15,000 on cutting your toenails. 88 videos for every single side street in San Francisco, at least 88. But you cannot find great, sensible videos about Russia, about the Volga, yes, about the Siberian foxes, yes, but honest, grand treatments of the street that the Bolshoi Theater is in. I didn't know any of this stuff. I read Encyclopedia Britannica physically for weeks and weeks and weeks in advance of this tour, doing my research so that I was moderately competent. I got here and I realized that I didn't have a clue. The orderliness of Russia, I'm not talking about a bowed down, crushed servitude. I'm just talking about the order, the discipline, the structure, the efficiency, the way things run has to be seen to be believed. Similarly, you kind of have to live through apartheid to appreciate. It's a bit like this. There is a very, very famous story, a Top Gear story, if you know what that is. I'll tell the anecdote briefly because it's universally applicable. James May goes drinking in Germany with two of his friends, an Australian and a German. And the Australian says to the German, "What do you do if you get caught speeding?" He said, we don't speed. You keep under the speed limit. So James, the Australian says, "Yeah, but let's say, your wife was in labor and she was in pain, and you raced her to the gynecological ward, the natal ward of the local hospital." The German said, "We do not do this sort of thing." So the Australian guy says to him, "Look, okay. I get it. But let me just give you another hypothetical scenario. Let's say you had been caught doing something bad, driving drunk or something, you have your license taken away, and then you get caught again driving while without a license." And the German, apparently, according to James May, just went berserk, saying, "In South Africa, it was not permissible to murder, therefore you didn't murder. It was not permissible to rape, therefore rape was a moot point. There was no rape." I'm exaggerating, just as the German was exaggerating. But by and large, that crime was, it was beyond conception. Not that it didn't happen, it was, as a concept, alien. It's not going to happen. It's not going to be tolerated. And if it does happen, it's going to be stamped out so definitively that it won't happen for the next 20 or 30 years or what have you. There was a disciplined, orderly society as you find in Russia. People here leave their doors open, leave their wallets on the restaurant table, go to the toilet, leave their phones blank. But there's no litter. None. Zero litter. No. It's a society that's functioning, and it reminds one very much of apartheid South Africa, where you didn't have to worry about murder, robbery, or rape, because there is no murder, robbery, and rape. Whereas now, as you rightly say, we have one of the highest, we have the definitively by far the highest rate of rape in the world. We're in the top, I think, five in murder rates in the world, competing with Honduras is number one. Six of the top 10 most dangerous cities in the world are South African. Our unemployment rate is about 38%, but our full unemployment rate, when you don't factor in all those stupid riders and qualifiers that government's putting in, like your American inflation rate is supposedly minus 1,000%, when in fact it's positive 25%. You know, if you look at the price of a thing that you buy, our real unemployment rate is over 50%, and our youth unemployment rate, that's people below the age of 30, I believe, is something like 60-something%. So, yeah, it's a society that has absolutely crumbled in the span of 35 years from the time that the African National Congress took over. You know, the inflection point is beyond dispute. There was nothing else to which this could be ascribed but abysmally poor governance.
Yeah, I think, well, Simon, I think that takes us to what is the current state of South Africa now? Where and how do you see it?
Well, this doesn't represent everything, but I'll give you some easy arithmetic here. We know from the 2017 land audit that there are about 25,000 white commercial farmers left in South Africa. We have about 33,000 ostensibly commercial farmers, so there's about 8,000 commercial black farmers, most of them non-functional, but there are 25,000 functioning white farmers. The United Nations measures murder in intentional homicide rate per 100,000. 25,000 to make 100,000 is multiplied by 4. The rate of murder or the number of murders per year of white commercial farmers, not their wives, not visitors on the farm, not uncles, aunties, employees, whatever, just white commercial farmers themselves, it varies from year to year, obviously, between low 40s to low 50s. Let's take an average of 45, which is a low average. It should be probably 47, if I was to surmise, over maybe like a five-year moving average measurement. And let's call it 45. 45 times 4 is an easy number. It's 180. Our farmers' murder rate is 180 per 100,000 per year. But
wow,
as dishonest as the world is, it says that, in fact, the most dangerous profession in the world is logging, with a death rate of 97.8. So the murder of white farmers is twice as high as the supposed most dangerous occupation in the world. And the murder rate in the USA, again, everybody knows, the USA is just saturated with murder, people shooting one another all of the time, ban the guns, the Americans, you know, the neurosis, the hysteria is between 4 and 5 per 100,000 per year. So my advice to you guys is, if you're serious about this whole murder thing, come to South Africa and get a lesson, because you're not trying hard enough. It's pathetic, your effort. 4, 5 per 100,000 a year. Disgraceful.
Well, and like you said, that was just the farmers. So if you add in employees, wives, children, all that stuff, I mean, that number's got to be astronomical. And I would think that it'd be multiple times over.
Yeah, of course. That's just the farmers, 45 guys a year, roughly speaking.
Wow.
But the murder rate in South Africa is, Sherbert, I haven't looked at this figure for some time, but the last time I looked at it was 57 a day.
Wow. And we're not talking about white farmers killing other white farmers either.
No, there's none of that. It's entirely a race-based thing. So you've got 45 white farmers a year dying, but across the whole of South Africa, our entire murder rate per day is, if I'm not mistaken, I could be mistaken, it's been some time since I looked up the figure, it's about 57 human beings a day are murdered in South Africa, and we've only got a population of, according to the government, 60 million, of which about 45 million are black, and the other 15 million are made up of whites, about 4.5 million, and then the Indians and the coloreds, about 5 million each-ish. I'm playing fast and loose with the numbers here, but
right.
You know, if it's not 5, it's 5.5. If it's not 5.5, it's 4.5. It's there or thereabouts. So about 45 million blacks, and then whites, colored, Indians. Yes, about 40 million blacks, 4.5 million whites, 5 million colored, 5 million, 45 million, 5 million, 5 million, 5 million makes 60 million. Yeah. Yeah, roughly.
Okay. Now, what are, there's, I mean, these are just murders. These are just people that are just going out and killing the white farmer, basically. Mm. I mean, from what I understand, it's, I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. Are they robbing them? Are they stealing? Are they trying to take their land? Are they trying to take their equipment? Is it just a hatred thing? I mean,
for a long time, they tried to tell us that we were mentally retarded. The best expression I've ever heard in my life is from the USA. Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? The guys in the South used to tell me that's how our elites and the Northerners and the academics and the media treat us. They treat us like we're mentally retarded, as if we can't observe things for ourselves. And right. So they have this expression, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? And that's, we were for a long time treated like that. They would say, the government would tell us that we were being nasty if we attributed it to anything but starvation. And then, you know, people started to say, yeah, but how does raping an 8-year-old girl help your stomach?
Right.
You know, how does 4 men raping to death a 12-year-old farmer's daughter alleviate your hunger pangs? And the government progressively began to look stupid, and so that line of attack went away. There is theft and robbery and avarice involved. Avarice as a motive, greed. I want your money. But the viciousness with which the murders are perpetrated, often by people who don't know the farmer. So again, the government tried to do this: who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Don't you know that those murders are retribution for the racist behavior of the farmer? Okay. And then it turns out 6 months later, when all the suspects are arrested, that they're from, you know, 300 miles north, and that they come in to an area that they didn't know specifically for the purpose of perpetrating the deed. So therefore, it couldn't have been retribution or reparations or retro anything. So it's all nonsense. It's just absolute. It's
well. And that takes me to my next question. So when something like that happens, do they do an investigation? Do they make an active effort to find who did it and justice? Is there any justice when they apprehend some of these guys that, you know, go in and rape a 12-year-old girl or an 80-year-old girl? What happens?
Yes, and no. The South African Police Service, as a service, has declined like night from day since the 1980s or the early and mid 1990s. You can scarcely compare the two. It's the one aspect of our state that has possibly deteriorated the most.
Okay.
But if you cultivate or nurture good relationships, as the farming communities attempt to do, with your local police force, and if you as a farming community band together to assist the police in pursuit of the perpetrators, then often there are good results. So it's a yes and no question, a yes and no answer, I should say.
Okay.
Along those lines, Simon, what would happen if a farmer repelled this attack and maybe killed one of the attackers? What would that look like? Is it a two-tier justice system? Or, like, you know, we hear of the instances of the farmers being murdered. Are there instances where they're defending themselves successfully?
Yeah, a friend of mine was attacked on his farm some years ago. And as luck would have it, you know, he's a, like all South African farmers, he's a very religious man. He said, you know, only grace, only the Holy Spirit. I had nothing to do with it. He happened to have been cleaning his weapon on his desk. And so he managed to just run away, and he would have been pursued and slaughtered. But he ran to his desk, grabbed his firearm and turned in one motion and shot all four of the guys dead.
Oh my word.
So he was in trouble for that. But in the end, you know, reason was seen. So it's an iffy thing. The credit must be given where it's due. sometimes the courts will surprise you with good, sensible decisions. And then sometimes you hear of court decisions that just make you think that there's no hope for the country at all.
Jason and I were talking recently. What is the current situation as far as firearms ownership in South Africa? How does that work?
The government continually tries to change the firearms ownership laws. And to, you know, we're going through the same thing as you guys are going through, except it's 100 times more intense here. I mean, there's very little prospect of them banning gun ownership in the USA, in spite of what the pink-haired, hairy, armpitted, knotty-haired, sandal-wearing liberals in your society say after every, and may heaven forfend it, school shooting in the USA, as tragic as they are. So, yeah, it's very much worse here. The government is trying very hard to ban firearms ownership. A new bill is being proposed in the parliament, was being brought to be proposed. But for now, you can own, except that you can only own one of each sort of weapon, let's say a pistol, a revolver, a rifle barrel, and a shotgun. And even that's not so easy. If you're a dedicated sports shooter, then you can own far more than that. You know, if you can prove that you're going to the Olympics or that you're in competitions every day or you represent your state or your county, we don't have that system here, but it'll be easier for your listeners if I don't use words like province or magisterial district or whatever. Yeah, so if you represent your state or your county, but then there's a lot more leniency, but you can only have 200 rounds at any given time and only one of each of those sorts, unless you are able to demonstrate that you are a very, very serious competitive shooter. And in order to get a license for each of all of those weapons, you have to do a written test and a practical test and then submit an application that may take 6 months to be approved and has to contain character references and all sorts of things. So they make it difficult as they can.
Okay, let me ask you this. Are most of the farmers then out there, the white farmers, are they armed? Do they exercise this right and have firearms?
Yeah, every white farmer has firearms.
Okay.
You know, we have, you know, to put too fine a point on it, I don't want to make it sound like we're living in, I don't know where, but, you know, we have black mambas, green mambas, boomslang, we have four different types of cobra, and worst of all, puff adders, and very, very vicious pigs, and warthogs, and jackal, and hyena, and the list never ends, so... every farmer must have firearms for all sorts of purposes, defending himself. I almost said varmints. I was thinking of the American colloquial word vermin. So all farmers have firearms. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Good. Good.
If they didn't, the farm murder rate would be. I'm positive. It would run to 200 a year, but maybe 300 a year. The 45 a year, the nominal average that I adopted for this conversation, is because farmers are defensible and because they're competent and because they're renowned, particularly Afrikaner farmers, as among the best shots in the world. Jeez, if they didn't have firearms, it would be very bad.
Yeah, it'd be a slaughter. Okay, that answers that question, and I don't want to get sidetracked, but I do have a question. So these blacks that are coming in and attacking, like, I don't know, over here we would call them gang members. How are they getting armed?
I'll give you one example, one illustration. at the, shortly prior to, or shortly after, shortly prior to, I believe, the first multiracial elections in South Africa of the 27th of April, 1994, the United States of America sponsored an exercise in destroying firearms. So the South African Defense Force of apartheid fame brought its firearms, I forget the number, a million and something. There were parameters. They didn't have to bring every firearm, and in any case, the South African Defense Force, everybody knew, was about to be taken over by the African National Congress. The African National Congress was bound to win the first multiracial elections, hands down. So they brought a million and something firearms. The African National Congress turned in a few thousand with a straight face, even though we know that in one operation alone, the African National Congress smuggled over 2 million firearms into South Africa in the 1980s. The firearms that are used in every bank robbery, in every cash-in-transit heist, you know, when armed vans are carrying money from a store, from the Walmart to the bank, the cash notes, we have, it's big in South Africa, cash and transit heist. Every last firearm is from the African National Congress's secret stockpiles that they claimed to have handed in 1992 during this US-sponsored exercise known as Operation Mouflon, or they are stolen from the Defense Force, or they are stolen from the South African police. Time after time after time, this thing is proven. There are no exceptions to this. Every one of those firearms either comes from the ANC as a party, or the ANC as the army, given that it has populated the army with its members for the past 35 years, or the African National Congress as the police. It is the ANC, it is the ANC, it is the ANC, it is the ANC, it is the ANC that provides these firearms in every single last instance.
Wow. Okay.
And it's
there's nothing new. Go ahead.
Yeah, Ron. The ANC is the ruling party of South African government, correct?
Yes. The African National, it stands for African National Congress. It's the party of Nelson Mandela that took power in 1994 and is still in power today, 35 years later. 31 years later. Sorry, I keep on saying 35. I beg your pardon. 31 years. I don't know where
I want to circle back, and I would be remiss if while I have this time with you, I don't ask you this, because you said something, and it may be purely speculation, your answer on this, but I want to ask the question. You talked about blacks who are perpetrating these farm murders coming in sometimes, you know, 300 kilometers, 300 miles away. And immediately I don't know if I put on my conspiracy hat or what happened, Simon, but I thought to myself, first off, how are they getting there, and how do they know where to go when they get there? Is it purely by chance, or what's happening?
Well, it's not valid in every case. My point was just that they keep on presenting these arguments that are meant to tone down the situation. You know, there was a farm murder. Oh, yeah, but they were hungry. Yeah, but then why did they rape?
Right.
There was a farm murder. It's because that farmer was a very fierce man. No, that none of them has ever worked for him. There's no you know, this is over and over and over again. They provide these doctrinal, trite cliches. They come up with it's like you and a black man get into a fight on the street in your local town. Well, it's because Will is a white supremacist. Then right. You have to defeat that argument. Then it's because Will is, you have to defeat that. If you're white, your motive can only be hatred. And because you hate black people, you blame them for doing nasty things when, in fact, they had jolly good reason. So you have to engage in an intellectual exercise to demonstrate that that is doctrinal rubbish. It's this is the standard liberal response to everything, and it's false. Not every farm murder involves robbery. Even those that do involve robbery are often perpetrated by gangs that as opposed to starving individuals. So if you ask me that question, as much as it doesn't apply in every case, there are many recorded instances of guys scoping out targets from a long way away. And for that purpose, they've developed a quite an interesting phenomenon called Africa signs, whereby scouts will be sent out, let's say to Jason's farm, or to identify a farm in a region, let's say northeastern Pennsylvania, and a gang is looking for marks. So two guys will traipse through northeastern Pennsylvania, wherever, and they'll come across Athens Township, Sayre, and the neighboring village. They'll go through Horseheads, New York, and Elmira, and then they'll go back to, Pittsburgh, to their leader. And they'll say, we've found seven farms. They're at such and such and such and such and such a location. And we've put little signs there that will enable the next team of guys that goes to read those places, to identify those places. It's quite elaborate and sophisticated. It's not something that I've ever delved into very deeply. It's not one of my chosen areas of study. But a good friend of mine, is a bit of an expert in this field. And when you're presented with the visual evidence, these guys have obviously learned over time what's going on. It's absolutely fascinating to observe how premeditated and long-sighted these target selections are, depending upon how vulnerable the people are. So preferably it should be an old lady whose husband has recently died. And as a widow, she's defenseless, and her children have not yet inherited the farm. Or whatever the case may be, it's one old lady and seven workers. There are all sorts of criteria. It's quite an interesting thing.
So it would be fair to say, in many cases, it's organized and orchestrated, not random.
No, heavens above, dear me, Will, I don't want to exaggerate, but I would say 19 out of 20 times it's organized.
Oh, wow.
Orchestrated.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's certainly not how it's reported here, Simon. As you were saying that, these are farm workers that were angry over back wages or whatever the case may be. That's how it's reported here when we do hear about it. It's certainly not it's not told to us that this is more of an organized effort, what we would consider to be organized criminal activity here of, coming from a different location and seeking targets of opportunity. And that's certainly what it sounds like.
There was an event on the farm. I have a friend who is a very successful young farmer, sort of a workaholic type maniac, who's done extremely well for himself and expanded his small inheritance into something very large, and he doesn't, he's not able to get to every part of his farm every day. And so he asked me if I would occupy one of the farmsteads. And so I live in an enormous, beautiful farmstead at the base of the Bamboo Mountains in the Eastern Cape, outside the town of Hofmeyr, the little village of Hofmeyr, I should say. And there was an incident among our farms about a year and a half ago in late 2023. And it came out that incident had been planned over months and months and involved all of the farm workers, but not as matters of back pay or whatever. It was a matter of the outsider comes in, he gets hold of one farm worker, he says to him, look, will you keep your mouth shut? And the guy says, yeah, okay. And the next guy, will you keep your mouth shut? And it ended up involving scores of people, but it was like a mafia operation. You know, you think of mafia operations as a guy standing on the corner stealing 10 bucks as you go by instead of whacking you on the nose. When you watch an American movie, it turns out that these sort of elaborate money laundering schemes and, you know, all sorts of very sophisticated crimes. And it's not exactly in that class, but it ended up involving scores of farm workers and months of endeavor. And it was somewhat connected to another stock theft operation, which again turned out with lie detector tests to involve almost all of the farm workers of all of the farms for 30 kilometers in any direction. And these things are very, very much organized crime, as you called it, Will. This story that is kind of reflex upset is nonsense.
Blair, what do you see is how does the political history of South Africa resemble the United States?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, yes. I think you lost me. Is that correct?
No, you're on.
I apologize. I turned my video off because I got the impression. Sorry.
That's okay.
How does it resemble the United States? That's a very interesting question. I think that there are few resemblances apart from the timing of the founding, the Jonestown settlement and all of that kind of stuff, the 1600s, 1652 in the case of South Africa, just 20 or 30 years later. I think we are more different than similar, except in one very, very, very interesting way. And that is the attack upon the morality and the morale of the core of the USA by fundamentally outsiders like the Frankfurt School at Columbia University and all of these guys. Fundamentally outsiders on a similar trajectory. And when I toured in 2017, I said to many people that, or let me illustrate it this way. In 2019, I was invited to give a speech at quite a prestigious conference in Tennessee. And I spoke about how it was palpable that there would be violent riots in the USA soon. And afterwards, I was heavily criticized. And then, of course, Portland happened, and I started receiving these text messages from people from all over the USA who had been in the room when I gave that speech. And I said to people, it's not that I'm a guru. It's that I've watched this video before. I've watched this. I know how it works. And as early as 2017, during that six-month tour, I said to people over and over and over again that it is conspicuous how you are being eaten, your morality and your morale, your what we would call courage in Afrikaans, your moed is being eaten from within. And I said, you're going to experience an explosion in LGBTQ and in interracial advertisements on your television like you cannot imagine. It will come out of nowhere, and you will not be able to fathom how it came so much so quickly. And, of course, people dismiss that, you know. And lo and behold, it's easy to see. Your society has been discouraged, this is a very common expression in our idiom. The courage, the strength, the testosterone, the I don't want to be too crass, the spine, the gut, the better part of your society has been convinced for a long time now that it is wicked, that you built me a jacuzzi and I'm enjoying every minute of frolicking in it, but all that proves is that you're a bad human being. You know, your work, your labor, your Protestant work ethic, your European values and norms and mores, because they do come from somewhere, and you can, you know, go shift as uncomfortably as you like in your chair, but they come from Europe, nowhere else, without exception. None of what made the USA great came from Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Peru, or Malawi. Zero.
Amen.
And yeah, I said you're going to see all this stuff coming out of the blue as they did to us. So in that way, I would say that's a very intuitive question, Jason. As I know myself, I'll go to sleep tonight with that on my mind, trying to fathom parallels that I might have missed along the way.
You know, I just want to follow up quickly on that. You mentioned the Frankfurt School and kind of that hidden hand of indoctrination that just sort of infects the university systems, the public school systems. Do you think, and I don't know, but in South Africa, was it that same sort of hidden hand? Were it the same players, the same folks?
The same players. You came to me sorely, Will. The same players.
You speak,
the
same speak players. Freely, Simon, please.
The same players. It's it's the same players. The same players. George Galloway, the British politician, left-wing politician, which in a sense gives him more credibility in this case, describes in a speech at the Oxford Union who it was that was the hidden hand in the collapsing of apartheid in South Africa. The same people
Will you share that with us, of what Mr. Galloway said?
Yeah, it's basically Talmudism and Judaism for the Goy. So Talmudism using Freemasonry as its proxy to convince you that you're wicked for building bridges or whatever the hell it is that you did, and for not giving it free to other people because you're supposed to love your neighbor. And the Scofield Bible, you know, all of this kind of fictional stuff that came out of nowhere. But you are required to believe right now because I believe it. And if you don't, then you hate, you know, hate children and hate old people. This
right.
Frantic fourth wave lean in feminist urge to tell you that you're bad no matter how hard you try to do good. Yeah, same. It's always the same. We see it in Europe now. Always the same proxy forces fulfilling the same pre-scripted destruction of society as Karl Marx. I mean, this is actually, you know, what I told my son the other day about the greatest lies. The greatest lie has to be that communism is atheist. Karl Marx writes so beautifully about his devil worship. When I say beautifully, I mean, you know.
Eloquently,
Yeah. And in the fourth critique of Hegel, he describes, I mean, he says in blunt terms, when will communists get it into their thick head that the first goal of communism is the destruction of God? And the Christian family on earth, father, mother, and child, is a mirror image of God. And if I want to get the words right, and if we can destroy the Christian family on earth, we will be halfway to pulling God out of heaven and having the true ruler on the throne of heaven. It is satanic from the Alpha to the Omega. And they've done a fantastic job of convincing us, no, it's atheist, don't you know it's atheist? And then you see what's going on in Europe, and you listen to these people talk. I follow certain guys that are difficult to follow because you've got to have a familiarity with with other languages. You know, the sermons are given in a multiplicity of languages. When you see how the writing that they're doing these expositions on, you know, these sermons, matches what's happening in reality in Western society, in Christian society, it's a paradox or a dichotomy. Your experience it becomes a thing in two parts. On the one hand, you lose all hope. You think, well, they've got it sewn up, and they do. The only hope we have is in God. We have zero hope of winning this in the flesh. They have got us so sewn up, it's not true. But on the other hand, you experience a sense of relief. You think, oh, golly gee, I don't have to worry about this anymore. Mr. X told me that he was going, Colonel Mustard. Colonel Mustard said that he was going to kill Miss Scarlet using a candlestick in the dining room, you know, playing this board game as a child. And here I catch him standing over the body. It's him. It's him. It's him. It just is. And I think that puts me, for one, in a better position than most of the people that I speak to in the world, and most of the people that I regard as my peers, genuinely conservative Christians in the European tradition, who are struggling to come to terms with, well, why would they inject us to kill us? It doesn't make any sense. You know, why would they lie to us about this? God be true. Why is Keir Starmer doing everything that he can to destroy Great Britain? It just doesn't make sense. But it does make sense. It makes perfect sense. If you are a member of one of the, you know, sort of parts of that pedophiliac satanic death cult cabal that is utterly devoted to specifically the destruction of the Christ, then that's what you would do. Why wouldn't you?
I recently, Jason and I and our other host, Tim, on our Saturday program, we were talking about the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, who recently came out, and you may have seen this, Simon, where she characterized that all of Europe as a whole holds the values of the Talmud, and that's what has made Europe great. And for us, you know, one of the things that we look at there is it's easier for us to understand when they're no longer trying to hide it and trying to lie. You know, they're coming right out in the open and telling us. And for us, you know, that's the Luciferians are just making themselves known. And so it's interesting to me to hear you characterize this as the traditional morality of Europeans, no matter where they go across the globe, wherever they settle. You know, we can all be cousins from our origins of where we come from, but where we land, there has been societies, there's been civilization, there's been progress. We certainly make the physical area, the geographic area of where we go better. And there is certainly that underground, like we said, hidden hand movement just to destroy that. And it's interesting to me to get your perspective on that, because it totally lines up with our perspective, wouldn't you say, Jason?
I do. I agree 100%.
Yeah.
And I know that we are running short on time, but I got a couple more questions for you. Simon, what's your take on the South African refugees coming to the United States?
Good question. In 2017, I toured the USA for 6 months, and ours was, at that time, the first and the only such initiative. And at the end of the tour, a guy by the name of Charles C. Johnson, Chuck Johnson, who was, I don't want to exaggerate, but part of the White House or within the constellation of the White House or within the the White House's orbit, whatever is the correct term, but a man known to have been part of the Trump campaign, contacted me and said, the president has observed your progress over the past 6 months. He has become fascinated by the plight of the Boers, and he would like to bring a jumbo jet plane load of Boers to America. I said to Chuck Johnson, that is anathema to Saitlanders. We believe that we have an obligation as true patriots to stand our ground in South Africa. It would send the wrong message altogether to our members. So that thing was shelved. But that's where it comes from. In 2017, would it have been a year and a half later, John Bolton wrote an autobiography of his time in the White House, in which he mentioned in two places exactly that. This thing of the president being distracted by his fascination with getting Afrikaner, the Boer plight, or getting Afrikaners into the USA. So when it happened a few weeks ago, it came as no surprise to us. It has unleashed a bitterness and a resentment among many blacks that was to be expected, but which is quite unpleasant. They feel, why not me? Why them again?
Right.
Why them again? You know?
That's good. That's what we're getting over here, too. We got people that are up in arms, and it's like, oh, they're crying crocodile tears. They don't want the white Afrikaners. It's like, why aren't we bringing the black ones over here? And it's like, well, we want the good ones. We want some good seed stock.
Yeah, well, that's what you've got. I mean, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's introduction, the guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes, also wrote of his participation in the Second Anglo-Boer War, the war I described earlier on from 1899 to 1902. And his opening preface is word for word what I'm about to tell you. Some people have accused the Crown of waging an unsuccessful war because the British almost lost that war, and they were only saved by a purchase of precisely 1 million horses and mules from the USA, after they drained the entire British Empire. And the country almost went bankrupt. So many people were querying why the British, with, you know, force ratio of well over 20 to 1, far better technology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, logistics, et cetera, why had they struggled so much? And he said, well, we were fighting a kind of a Superman. We were fighting the Boers. What did you think? How did you think it was going to go? They've fought savages for centuries. They live in the worst farming conditions, or they farm in the worst conditions in the world. And at a full gallop, a teenage Boer with open sights can kill a leaping springbok at 400 yards with every shot. And he goes on and he says it's genetic. He says the three finest strains of white people landed up in South Africa. He said the Huguenots, that was a genetic thing, because they were able to resist the power of Spain and France for 300 years or whatever as Protestants. So he said, you knew to begin with that you were working with the strongest genes in Europe. And the Dutch, and then he proceeds to give some description of why Dutch genetics is superior, and then the Germans. And he said, you mix the three together and you get a kind of a Superman. What did you think was going to happen? We were going to get thumped. We were going to get it handed to us on a silver platter from day one. We scarcely stood a chance. If we hadn't plowed in 4 million animals, 400 million pounds, and 400,000 men against 36,000, by the way, we would have been back with our tails between our legs. My point being, it's not to be conceited, because I'm strictly speaking not of Boer stock, I'm of Irish stock all the way back. You will see in years to come for your own self, and I don't mind being tested, and I don't mind putting money on it, For me, it's not a bet in the sense of luck. So it's not that forbidden, the thing that's forbidden in the Bible to wager based on chance. I will happily put money down. Test those 49 against any 49 of the 490,000 Guatemalans that came in over the past 4 years. And let's see.
I like this guy.
Simon, along those lines, while we're talking about the recent events with the South African, the 49 that came in, I'm sure by now you've had an opportunity to, I don't know what you want to characterize it as, but the meeting yesterday between our U.S. President Trump and Cyril Ramaphosa, or is it Ramaphosa? Is that correct? The president of South Africa.
You don't have to get it right. It's Ramaphosa.
What you said. What is your take on that, Simon, of all of that clown show there that happened in D.C.?
When I was a child, corporal punishment was, and even with my own kids, I've given them hidings that they'll remember until their last day of their lives. For me, that was like you're at a family function and you get a little bit of a sugar high or too overly enthusiastic because of all of the energy around you, and you're running around screaming as a 5, 6, or 7-year-old boy. And you take it too far after the sixth time that your mother's told you to calm down, and eventually your father just grabs you by the left wrist and yanks you toward him, pulls your pants down in front of all of the aunties, and gives you, 30 slaps on the backside as hard as he can because he's had a rough week. And he's not interested in restraining himself for anybody's sake. And the worst of it is not the pain. It's not even the embarrassment of screaming blue murder in front of all of the aunties. They're always going to remember you as a crybaby. That's what's in your mind immediately. The worst of it is that they all got to stare at your bottom for 45 seconds. And that's what happened to Cyril Ramaphosa. He got yanked over Donald Trump's knee, had his pants pulled down, and was given a good spanking in front of the whole world. Will it change anything in South Africa? No. He's probably going to double down now. He's probably going to make it worse. But it's good that just the principle of the thing. He needed a good tanning on his backside. He needed a good spanking from a strong man with broad shoulders who can read and write and count and think and govern.
Good point.
Very good point. And I was by accident watching that press conference live at my office, and I had the TV on mute. I looked up and I realized I was looking at Joseph Malema and President Trump and Ramaphosa, and I thought, what in the world is going on? And I unmuted it, and all I could think is, well, it's about damn time that someone did this.
It was long overdue. And I think there'll be more of it. I think there's so much inevitable, unavoidable fractiousness developing in our society now as a product of the past 31. I apologize for continually saying 35 years earlier, the past 31 years of abysmally poor government by the African National Congress. That now the chickens are coming home to roost. Now our electricity supply is failing. Now our water reticulation system is failing. Now our hospitals are really taking great strain. The roads are in a shocking condition. Unemployment is going through the roof, and so on and so forth. The currency is being beaten to death. So I think there will be more of it, down the road. The ANC is going to have to take responsibility for the past 31 years, as Donald Trump made them take responsibility before the entire world yesterday or the day before, depending on what time zone you're in.
Simon, I know your time is precious, and we've taken a lot of it, and we're very appreciative appreciative of it today. I guess, Jason, my last question is the Sidelanders as an organization, what would be the best way for our listeners to one, learn more about the Sidelanders, two, support the mission of the Sidelanders? How would that look for us here in the United States to be able to help and support?
Yes, thank you very much, Will. I appreciate it. We're 100% a charity. Any help is gratefully received. We box way above our weight, and we carry a standard that really shouldn't be, you know, for world conservative Christianity. So please support us. You can go to saidlanders.org. It's S-U-I-D, Landers.org. You click on that link, and you go into the homepage. There's a portal where you can make donations. If you want to see more of my work, I'm the one who does the speaking in English. There is a channel, just type Simon Roche, Saidlanders. You'll be taken to that Saidlanders channel. I think it's called Saidlanders Media. It was recently rebranded. That's why I don't even know my own channel's name. There are three of us who work on it, a producer and a designer. So, yeah, Saidlanders Media on YouTube. There are hundreds of videos, or just search against my name and Saidlanders. We've been on BBC, CNN, Russia Today, Alex Jones, you name it. There's a lot of material that people will be able to gain access to. And in anticipation of any help, any financial help, excuse me, I'd like to say thank you very, very, very much. It's very much appreciated.
Absolutely. And like Will said, we do appreciate your time. You answered a lot of our questions today, and I look forward to, and I hope you'd be willing to come on and just give us kind of an update from here and there once in a while, and give us an update on current events and things that are happening over there. Because like me and Will have been talking recently, there's kind of a blackout on the news. You look for the news on what's going on in South Africa, and it's really hard to find very much information on the internet. And you read something, and then you go back and look for it, and it's gone. It's kind of blacklisted. So it's really beneficial for us, our audience, to be able to hear it directly from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
It's my pleasure. I'd gladly come on your show again. In fact, thoroughly appreciate the opportunity. The gratitude is reciprocal. The thanks come also from this side.
Amen. Well, Will, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Nope. Just thank you, Simon. This is much anticipated, and we're very appreciative. And just be safe in your travels.
Thank
Absolutely.
You. Thank you very much. I'm far safer in Russia. I haven't felt so safe in years. This place is fantastic. I don't say Russia is all good and everybody else is all bad. Not at all. But I do say that it is splendid here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. God bless you guys, and take care.
Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we thank you for listening to the Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network. The message that you just heard was recorded May 23rd, 2025. For more information, go to our website, www.scripturesforamerica.org. And we've got a little bit of time left. I think we're going to have a couple songs.
What have we done, O Father of our nation? How can we be so blind to our salvation? The blood, the tears, for freedom shed throughout the years. Our time has come. Oh, Father, what have we done? Doctors, lawyers, judges, guardians of our law, will you give the key of truth before we fall? The cause to you. Bring justice to our land. Preachers, destroy the lie. Return to our God's law. Decry democracy. Proclaim his sovereignty. Set all the captives free. Be willing to lose all. The price is not so dear as you might think or fear. You'll save your soul. You'll save your soul. Turn your head and look the other way. Your dreams, your tears, your lies are what you'll have to pay. They will take all you have. Too late, you're gonna say, what have we done? Oh, Father, of our land, where's your integrity? And what will you sacrifice to keep our people free?
Your wealth, your fame, your power, will you lay these things down
when called to stand alone and face the enemy?
Once great men threw their earthly fortunes to the wind, to die for righteousness, to live in nobleness, to dream for generations yet unborn. What will our children say if we their trust betray? We must be strong. We must fight on. What will our children say if we their trust betray? We must fight on.
I liked that song. I hope you did too. Remember, you're listening to the Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network. And let's see here. I think that we'll have a song titled Judas Advance next. Thank you.
and holding his head high. He's talking of an answer that will make a grown man cry. He's hoping for a better day and doing all he can. He's living and he's praying for a place to make his stand. An American is someone who knows just what he's got. He's not afraid to fight for it, to save his children's love. America is freedom, he calls it his last stand. And I'm proud of where I live and who I am. He's seen it in the faces of the people that he meets, a searching and a longing for the joy.
Fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. He that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Some say love drowns the tender reed. Some say love it is a razor that leaves your soul to bleed. Some say love it is a hunger and I say love, it is a flower, and you, its only seed. It's the heart afraid of breaking.
at night.